Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Thank you for coming to our panel. A couple things I have to do the business. I'm Greg Saris, the moderator. Turn off your cell phones. I got a big note about that. And to let you know that the authors that you'll be hearing this morning will be signing in the lobby right after the panel today. We want to have a big thanks. Is Steve Silberstein here? He sponsored this panel. Thank you, Steve. Are you around? Thank you so much. We appreciate it. I think I'm running into you somewhere else, but we'll see. And I was just given my watch, which means, Greg, don't be a professor. All right. So we'll begin, and I will take a seat in a second, but I'd like to begin by introducing our authors this morning. Before we begin our conversation, we have William Bauer here. Willie Bauer is here, professor, associate professor of history at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He's a member of the Wailaki and Conco tribes of Round Valley Indian Reservation and the author of We Were All Like Migrant Workers Here, Work, Community, and Memory on California's Round Valley Reservation, 1850 to 1941. His new book is California Through Native Eyes. Layli Long Soldier is the recipient of a Lannan Literary Fellowship, a Native Arts and Cultures Foundation National Artist Fellowship, and a Whiting Award. She lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and her book of poems, Whereas, is her first book and wonderful book. T.J. Stiles is the author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. He's a winner of the 2009 National Book Award in Nonfiction and the 2010 Pulitzer Prize in Biography. He also wrote Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War. He's a member of the Society of American Historians and a former Guggenheim Fellow. He lives right here in Berkeley, California, with his wife and two children. His latest book is Custer's Trials, which also won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize. Lewis Warren is the W. Turrentine Jackson Professor of Western U.S. History at the University of California, Davis, and the award-winning author of Buffalo Bill's America and The Hunter's Game. He lives in Davis, California. His new book is God's Red Sun. And I'm Greg Saris, as I mentioned, of several books I've written. I'm also a professor at Sonoma State University and serving my 13th consecutive term as chairman of the Federated Indians of Graton Rancheria. Good morning and welcome, everybody. Any of you misbehave, I cut you off. All right. What we'll do is we'll ask a few questions, and it's general. We can just move. But again, being a professor, I had to be somewhat organized here. Let's see. We'll start with T.J. Stiles right next to me. Custer, as you portray him, was a man of his times, caught in a rapidly changing world and driven by a romantic quest for a return to the past. Maybe you could talk a little about his predicament and how he sought to resolve the predicament in his life. And you know, what was really interesting too, what are some of the lessons of your characterization of this man that might be relevant today as we look at our national leadership and politics?
You mean a...
I couldn't avoid the question, folks.
You mean a ginger-haired, thin-skinned man who wants to take America back to the past and...
The hair.
Yeah. With flamboyant hair. Yeah. The interesting... Hang on, I'm just on your... Could you lean forward on your seat? Because I'm... There we go. You know, Custer, we're here to talk about Native history and past and present. And Custer is somebody who is always seen through that lens of that last moment in his life, which is a very significant moment, obviously for him. It really was a lucky break for him in some ways. But also, you know, a major moment in Native history. And yet, what happens is by compressing everything in his life into that singularity of that one day in June of 1876 is that we miss both his his role in history and what he tells us about history, and specifically about this very climactic era in 19th century U.S. history and Native history. And the fact is that Custer was somebody who was engaged with the emergence of modernity in the United States and helped to actually create the modern United States, and yet was someone who was unable to adapt to it personally. And he was a graduate of West Point. He was a product of the first professional training institution in the United States. He was a part of the first large systematic institution in the United States, the Army, which was the model for corporate America. He played a key role in the Civil War, which means he played a key role in emancipation. He also, people don't realize that he was a figure in Reconstruction, and that much of his post-year life, years of his post-Civil War life, were about hunting for the Klan and dealing with the aftermath of emancipation and race and ideas of race. And very conservative ideas about race, even for the time, were very much a part of his worldview. He was also somebody who tried to engage in the new national media. He was a popular writer. He tried to be kind of public intellectual. He was someone who was engaged in Wall Street, trying to make money in Wall Street. And all of these things are, in addition to the fact that he was a prominent figure in the frontier army, all of these things show the way in which that 19th century conflict in the West is between what historian Emanuel Wallerstein called world systems. And that you have the United States is a part of the European world system. You know, a market economy, that European state system that emerges that the United States is a part of. And you have Native people who have not only different adaptations to the environment, they have different, what you might call national relations. They have different ideas of what a people and a nation are. They have, it's a different world system. And the U.S. comes in, and Custer is right there at this point of conflict. And I don't want to go on too long, but, you know, this brings in issues of the environment. The first wars that he was involved in the 1860s really flowed out of the environmental damage of passage through to places like California, and the way that that had an impact on the environmental basis of the High Plains nations. He had as his personal, really domestic manager, a young escaped slave named Eliza Brown, who was black, and who represents the very complicated ways in which ideas about individual rights, which come out of Reconstruction, which are very important to the U.S. in good ways, were then used as a basis for destroying the group rights of Native peoples. And so his life, even long before the Little Bighorn, represents many ways in which these two world systems are coming into collision, and it leaves unresolved problems that we are still seeing today. And you look at the Standing Rock case, and just looking at it historically, you've got issues that are like the Transcontinental Railroad. You've got infrastructure being built through lands that are important to Native people. You've got a disregard of sovereignty. You've got all of these issues that we see coming to such a violent climax in the 19th century in Custer's life are still with us because they were left unresolved.
Well, thank you. We'll come back to Standing Rock.
Yeah, I know.
thank you, TJ. Lewis, Warren, well, Volcker, Jack Wilson, who is God's red son, influenced the spread of the 19th century ghost dance movement among many of the Plains tribes. The natives, in practicing the ghost dance religion, wished for a return to the past. Some might see such a quest as romantic. I'd like to have you say a few words about the native quest, its tenets, and how it might not only be seen as unreal or romantic, but also as a useful and practical response to colonialism and the natives' rapidly changing world.
Thanks, Greg. That's a great question. Let me explain first that my book is a history of the ghost dance religion of 1889-90, the ghost dance movement of 1889-90. A relatively brief period in the life of a movement that actually goes on a lot longer. This was a moment when this new religious movement swept Native American reservations throughout the West. As a historian, I'm trying to recover the testimony of Indian believers and others who lived through this time and to recover their accounts of witnessing and shaping these events. Now, the religion was inspired by the prophecy of Wovoka, who was a northern Paiute man in western Nevada. And the prophecy promised an Indian Messiah who was coming to save his Indian children and to restore the earth to its former abundance, and with it, Indian autonomy and freedom. Now, the religion was marked by this new ceremony, which becomes known ultimately to Americans as the Ghost Dance. And it's a ceremony, which is a circle, in which dancers would circle sometimes for hours. And ultimately, in many places, dancers fell into trances, and they would collapse into unconsciousness. And when they awoke, they said that they recounted visions of being in the other world, where they met their deceased kin, their departed children. Many, many Indian people on reservations in this period were losing children. Child mortality was at a very high rate, and there are many accounts of Native people meeting children in this afterworld. And also, they would sometimes meet God or the Creator or other spirits. This movement caused consternation and fear among U.S. officials who began to claim, actually, that it was the basis for a warrior uprising, and they tried to ban the religion in one of the places where it had found a particularly enthusiastic following among the Lakota Sioux in South Dakota. And it was there that the U.S. Army ultimately massacred hundreds of ghost dancers at Wounded Knee, ghost dancers who were almost entirely unarmed, I might add. And who were busily trying at that moment to come into the army and give up the rest of their arms. Now, this is a very painful history, especially for Native people who have lived with its legacy. And I'm very conscious, first of all, that I am non-Native, and I do this work as an outsider. And I work always to speak of it with care and respect. I should say I'm not an expert on the ghost dance. There's a common misperception, I think, that when historians get to writing on something, that makes them an expert. And what we do is we pick up the documents that tell us how we know about something, and we go back to those documents and we read through them and say, what can we learn from these? And I am a historian who just brought some questions to the historical documents about this moment in history. And then, to make sure I was getting my interpretation right, I consulted with people in the communities I was writing about, with people in Nevada, among the Northern Paiute communities at Yerington, and also at Pine Ridge, among Lakota people, and also in Oklahoma with Southern Arapahoes, some friends of mine there. Now, I want to say that in the past, I should say this, when I've spoken about this work to any crowd, it has been my great privilege to have in the audience families of ghost dancers and members of communities who were central to the stories I tell. Today, I'm on a panel with Lele Longsoldier, who is Oglala Lakota and a family from Pine Ridge. It's my great honor to be on this panel with all of these Native scholars and writers, and with T.J. Stiles as well. And I hope if anybody, I should say that sometimes in the past, when I've talked about this, people who have this experience of being related historically, familiarly to these events, have let me know that some of the things I say they think were wrong or I'm leaving something out. And I hope if anybody here fits that description today, you'll share with me your concerns. This book is not the last word on the ghost dance. No history book is the last word on anything. It's part of an ongoing conversation, and it's just a contribution to that conversation. I'm happy to talk to anybody about my interpretations, and I want to invite yours. Now, if all that is by way of preface, and Greg's, I don't want to keep going on. So what I mean, Greg's terrific question. The ghost dance is, we often see it, is presented in the history books as this religion, just as I described it, in which people sought to dance to go back to the past. And that this is, in the history books, is presented as this romantic and naive moment among these people. And my problem with that story is that in telling it that way, it becomes an excuse for what happened. When we pronounce people as being so benighted as wanting to go back to the past and they're romantic and naive, then we begin to apply that word primitive to them. This is often happens in the textbooks. Right? And once you start to call somebody primitive, you can put them in a box. And then you can bury them. Or you can put them in a museum. And in reality, ghost dancers were astonishingly modern. Right? First of all, I don't think there's anything more modern than wanting to go back to the past, as TJ's just suggesting there, right? With Custer, right? There's something everybody wants. And every time I speak to anybody who's Christian, and I say to them, what is heaven like for you? None of them say, oh, hey, you know, in heaven, I'm going to have like this awesome 55-inch or 60-inch TV screen and a new car. You know, it's what they usually describe as a countryside of hills and lakes. It's usually pre-industrial. Right? It's usually the past. Right? There's that. I think that this, in wanting to return to a former era in which they had freedom and autonomy and food, right, an era before the wildlife and wild foods of Nevada and the Great Plains had been destroyed by mining and by invasion of the Americans, by the settlers, right? There's nothing that's pre-modern about longing for the better life. And the other thing I should say is that in the course of this book, I found that the ghost dancers would say, the Messiah, the prophet, Wovoka, he taught his followers that the Messiah will come, but you have to do these things in order for him to come. You must dance, this dance, but you must also love one another and keep the peace. And he also said, you must go to work for money. You must send your children to school. You must become farmers. You must go to church. All these churches are mine. He said, pick a church and go. You must do these things to get through the day-to-day, I think, is what he was saying, until the Messiah can come for us. And it's all this, you read this, and these people are so modern and inspired and ecstatic and pragmatic all at the same time.
All right. Thank you, Lois. William Bauer. In 1935, a state emergency relief administration grant allowed Alfred Kroeber from right here, UC Berkeley, to conduct ethnographic research on several California Indian tribes. The stories told to Kroeber and other ethnographers by these California Indians provided a counter history to settler history, basically your thesis, that became politically relevant for those same Indian tribes. Maybe you could talk some about the ways those stories helped the tribe in their quest for social justice. And what can these stories teach non-natives about the same history? As I said earlier, I jokingly say about California Indians, nobody knew we were here until there were casinos.
That's right. Thanks, Greg. The title of my book is California Through Native Eyes. And in a lot of ways, it was a response to the first book that I wrote. The first book is entitled We Were All Like Migrant Workers Here, which was a history of California Indians from the Round Valley Reservation as migrant farm workers in Mendocino County in Northern California. As Louis was saying earlier, right, as historians, we go into the archives, we find documents, and many times these documents are produced by non-Indian people. And so for my first book, I made it an effort to do oral history interviews. I needed to understand how California Indians themselves understood work and labor. And through that process, it prompted a thought for myself. What if we only used California Indian sources to tell California history? And I had the kind of the luck to find a, in the 1930s, there was a New Deal era public works project that was conducted in California. So Alfred Kroeber received money from the state of California to conduct kind of anthropological, ethnographic research in two places, up in Mendocino County, where I'm from, and then over in the Owens Valley of Eastern California. And so through this process, I found where these records were. They're here at the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, and I was skimming through the finding aid, and I found an interview with my great-grandfather. His name was Charles Wright. He's a member of the Concow tribe. And so no one in my family knew about these documents. No one had actually heard or read these stories in our family since the 1930s. So the first thing that I asked for from the archivist was this collection of stuff. I wanted to read the family stories first. And the first story my great-grandfather told, or that was recorded, is entitled The Story of Jesus. Right? Jesus could kill 1,000 geese with one shot of a slingshot. Jesus traveled north and he gambled with his enemies. Jesus defeated his enemies in these gambling games and he took all of their hearts. And he asked Chicken Hawk to fly him back to his home, which is near Chico, California. And so when Jesus got back to Chico, he threw those hearts into a lake and he went to sleep. And the next day, he got up, he went to that lake, and there were people milling about around the lake. Right? Jesus then named all the tribes, and he sent them in their own direction. This is the story of Jesus that you're most familiar with? Actually, but you know, maybe given the audience, maybe this is the story of Jesus that you're most familiar with. Right? And so what this sparked for me was to kind of rethink, so what does this story mean in the history of California? Because I think what it does, not only is it kind of a Concow understanding of creation, but it's also a counter narrative to kind of California history. And I think one of the most compelling aspects of that is that it is rooted in place. Based on this story, we don't know when Jesus traveled in Northern California, right? But we know where. We know exactly where, because my great-grandfather was explicit that said that the lake where the people were all created is where Chico, California is right now. And so that these oral traditions and these oral histories that California Indians told in the 1930s were a way of reclaiming place. So maybe I can kind of give another example. Another Concow gentleman told a story about a place he called West Mountain, right? So that's a Concow term translated into English. Today, we know that place by the name Lassen Peak. Right? So the two ways of naming that place, I think, speaks to kind of different historical understandings and different relationships with the past, right? So in the oral tradition that the gentleman told about West Mountain, the people's relationship always positions that mountain to the west of them. So the sun always sets behind that mountain. People are traveling to that mountain. They're moving from east to west, right? So there's kind of a directional component. And by telling that story and rethinking about that story, it reminds people that Concow people should always be to the east of that mountain. We should always see West Mountain to our west. That's not how settlers understand this, or that's not how the state of California understands the history of that place, right? Lassen Peak commemorates a pioneer history of California, right? That when people, and so it celebrates the fact that pioneers invaded Northern California and renamed its landmarks. And it's important to kind of think about that, because kind of naming is a powerful act. It imparts meaning on the landscape. And to name a place Lassen Peak assumes that it doesn't have another name. And so by actually naming the mountain, or using the name West Mountain again, it reminds people that there is an indigenous history in these places. There are indigenous meanings that have been placed on California's landscape, that after the California Gold Rush and the invasion of people into the state, that those efforts were kind of always attempted to be were attempted to be erased. And then I think maybe kind of the final way to think about this, and I'll come back to that, but in the story, this oral tradition that is about West Mountain, there's two figures in it. There's two prominent figures. One is Lizard, and the other is Mouse. Lizard is bullied. Like, people kick sand in her eyes, and when she kind of goes to wash out sand in her eyes, she's the first person to see fire on West Mountain. Right? Mouse comes to help the people steal fire from West Mountain, but no one believes him at the first time when he gives his ideas. And I think the compelling thing to kind of think about in this is that two seemingly weak and vulnerable people are actually the most powerful people in the story. Right? The person who's bullied is the first person to see fire. The smallest person in the community has the wisdom and the knowledge that's the most effective way to kind of reclaim and to acquire fire for the people. And so I think that these stories not only speak to, kind of, to the past of California, they speak to the present of California in the 1930s, but they also, I think, offered a way for California Indians to navigate and go forward in the future. Thanks.
Thank you very much. You, in reading your book, of course, I had to remember my great-grandfather, Tom Smith, who Kroeber and his folks also interviewed at the same time. And he said, he told my grandmother that he told mostly just lies. And she said, well, why were you talking to him? And he said, because I needed a good suit to be buried in. And the woman that was interviewing me, I like looking at her legs. So, William Bauer and T.J. Stiles. T.J., you wrote, quote, George Armstrong Custer lived on a chronological frontier even more than on a geographical one. This goes back to what you were talking about a moment ago, Willie. William Bauer suggests Indian people here, California Indian people in this case, understood who they were both as individuals and members of an autonomous nation in terms of place. That's how we knew who we were. Any thoughts, either of you or both of you, on the differences here and how these differences made for cultural blindness at the time, and how an understanding of these differences might help us not only understand the mishaps of the past, but provide pathways for clear-headedness and humility in intercultural contexts today?
I guess I'll go next since you were just speaking, though I'd rather listen. I'm just reminded of, in terms of looking at the world and how different people in different cultures literally see the world. I'm reminded of many years ago, I went to a museum that had a map display of maps from different cultures, and there was a Polynesian map of the ocean. And it was a map using bent reeds and shells to show the prevailing swell patterns between different islands, so that Polynesians would look at the ocean and they would see information. And they'd be able to navigate over the horizon by looking at what, to me, would be a completely blank, meaningless space. And it's very important to remember that when different people look at the same space, they are seeing different things. And the sense of priorities as well as raw power is what drives a lot of the conflicts that lead to the way the world is right now. You think of the California Gold Rush. And what happened is that people saw in this landscape this mineral, which, because of the way we organized our economy, was money. It was the medium of exchange and store of value. Gold was not a valuable resource, it was money. And so they find gold, people go there because it's free money. And money is the way we organize our economy. And then that leads to this massive migration, which leads to, even before people began to literally grab the lands and settle them on the high plains, and since Custer's life is about the high plains, you had these migrants going to places like California and then to Colorado when there's a gold rush there. And they're crossing over this landscape that they're following river bottoms. And the high plains were a very dry space in which, as Elliot West has written very insightfully about, you know, there's this vast landscape of grass, which is energy for horses and for bison. But it's also dry, and you need water. So 7% of the landmass of the high plains is our river bottoms, and only 7%. And that is the basis for the survival of both, in the 19th century, of both the high plains peoples who've taken to a horse-based economy and culture, and also the bison, which is their primary prey. and the material basis of their survival in this nomadic lifestyle. And they depended on surviving the winters on these river bottoms, where cottonwood bark provides grazing and there's shelter, et cetera. Those are also the paths that are taken by these migrants on their way to get gold. And so, and then they're migrating through, what are they doing? They're cutting down timber, they're destroying the grazing, they're destroying these resource islands. Then the army comes in to protect them, and it plants these little forts that don't have enough troops to actually stage offensive campaigns, but they put them at these resource-rich islands. And then the resources get consumed, migrants camp near the forts, and it turns them into deserts. And then this drives a process whereby there's resistance by, you know, peoples who are in conflict with each other, who have their own history, their own international relations, you could call it, and they resist. And they resist in ways that are fitting with their own history. And they negotiate, and again, there's these negotiations, the way we hear their voices from the 19th century is when they meet up with army officers especially, who negotiate with them. And they actually describe the environmental pressures on them, and because the army and federal officials don't see the world in the same way, they don't understand that landscape when they look at it in the same way, because the U.S. economy was about, you know, you harvest resources, you develop them, then you transport them to where you need them. And so they're saying, look, let us through. All we want to do is go through. Yeah, we know, you know, we're marching through these areas, but we're just passing through. They see the landscape differently. And, you know, Custer comes in, and he is not making policy, but he's serving a couple of roles. One is that he's he's fighting in these conflicts that derive from this environmental conflict. But he's also, and he actually plays, you know, an important role, exaggerated in some ways, but still, we shouldn't dismiss it in terms of just what he does. You know, very destructive role, but a very real role. And he also dramatizes it, and he writes about it. And he writes a memoir about his early years on the plains. And the first two chapters, much of it's this kind of romanticization of life in the West and of Native people. But also, the first two chapters of that memoir are not this kind of dramatized adventure story of his life. They're an attempt to represent the natural history of the West, including Native peoples. And he draws upon the science of the day, which again sees human beings in this worldview which was supposedly scientific, and yet had these, according to the racial science of the day, had these racial gradations which said that certain peoples have inherently different traits. And yet Custer has this experience where he's outmarched, outfought, out-argued, in many ways by Native peoples, and he's got to fit it into this scientific, supposedly scientific scheme. And so, you know, the U.S. is marching forward to acquire resources, to go where its people have gone in their pursuit of resources, to impose this world system upon a different world system. And Custer represents this person who's there looking at the world in this, you know, particular way, and trying to figure it out, because the way he looks at the world doesn't actually describe the way it is. And yet, you know, the raw conflict develops in the way it does, and it's never fully thought through. And it leaves this strange, very destructive aftermath in which the 19th century is still inflicting itself upon many Native people today, while the rest of the United States is, you know, kind of, it's odd. Like you said, they don't even know they exist. Entire peoples that have very ancient histories. And so, again, this way of looking at the place and understanding it and the way they come into conflict drives a lot of what happens in the 19th century.
Well, thank you. And I'll hear, you know, you're making me think. We simply say that when the Europeans came, they destroyed our Bible. The landscape is our sacred text. It's how we know one another. And when, whether it be stream or trees in a certain area, they were mnemonic pegs on which all stories of who we are and how we know ourselves were pegged. And when that was destroyed, we nothing had very difficult time reading who and what we were anymore. It's very, very different. I'll let you go.
Yeah, I think maybe to kind of build on that, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking of about the question is that I think that there's a tension between native places and American land, Right. So in the histories that I was talking about, and the oral histories that I was reading and hearing about, is that place tended to structure much the narrative and the organizational framework. So in the oral traditions that I was reading, it mattered where a thing happened, not when. Right. Store, even in the narrative itself, events move from place to place, like specifically named places, from place to place, not date to date. And I think these are kind of fundamentally kind of different ways of conceptualizing the world in which we live now, but also kind of how we understand the past, present, and future. The United States, on the other hand, I think approached this from the perspective of land, right? If we think about land being a commodity, something that can be bought and sold, and it tends to kind of sever, it ignores the significance of specific and certain places. So when I teach, you know, kind of a general survey of American history, I get up on the first day and I say, American history is a story of it's this two narratives, right? American history is the story of taking indigenous people's lands, enslaving African Americans, and dealing with the consequences of those two acts, right? And it's 2017, and we're still dealing with the consequences of those two acts, right? And so, I think, maybe since I kind of construct that narrative, I'm a little bit kind of pessimistic about finding, kind of reconciling these two views, because I'm not sure that indigenous conceptions of place work well with American perceptions of land. And actually, kind of TJ's discussion there about Custer and the High Plains, one of the best examples of this is the Black Hills of South Dakota. Right, the center of the Lakota world. I don't mean to kind of cut in here, but you know, in the 1980s, there were efforts to kind of restore federal land in the Black Hills to Lakota people, and people opposed that. Right, and I think in part it is part of that narrative is because the United States rests so much of its history, so much of its identity, on taking indigenous people's lands.
I just want to say one thing really quickly. I don't need other people's time. But, you know, it's very easy for us today to try to fit the story of Native people into this template, which is driven by the idea of the Civil Rights Movement, which, you know, is a great important moment that, again, restores Reconstruction. It's about bringing back Reconstruction. Well, 1870, this brief period, 10 years after the Civil War, we create the idea of universal citizenship, universal individual rights. But then what happened, though, is that idea was then used as a justification for destroying the sovereignty and group identity and group rights of Native people. So the Congress in 1871 that passes the Ku Klux Klan Act, the first Voting Rights Act, it put the federal government, including Custer unwillingly, in the business of suppressing the Klan and protecting voting rights in the South. That same Congress passed a law saying no more treaties with Indian nations. We're not going to treat them as sovereign peoples anymore. And so that very idea of what they thought the most humanitarian people at the time were all about, we have this universal system and your system has no place on this continent. And so, you know, even the way we think about it now is influenced by that then, and we have to get out of that just universal template idea. It gets very complicated and the simplistic morality doesn't fit.
All right. Layli, we come to you in your book of poetry. I found it stunning and beautiful, I just have to tell you. You call up the past or history as it plays out in the present, specifically for your Lakota people. Your poetry interrogates language itself, specifically its ability to capture the pain of history and our lived, and I mean Indian lives, today. In his biography of George Custer, T.J. Stiles mentions, briefly, quote, the largest mass execution in U.S. history when in 1862, 38 Sioux were hanged in Mankato, Minnesota. You have a poem, and it really struck me, called 38, that covers the same event, both questioning historians who might write about it and the effectiveness of language to recount the horror. They say here, don't have people read. I would ask you, I'd love it, I'd be honored if you just read a couple of the last pages of your poem, then we can go from there, Layli. Thank you.
Would it be okay if I stand at the podium?
You can do whatever you like, sure.
Easy
make
to
sure
read
there's a, is there a mic over there? Is that, yes, the mic works, I just used it. I don't have any memory.
Hi, I'm standing because I read better when I stand up. Leilia kichita hanskai machiapi da ya hippi na chante washte na bechu zapi. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you. I've written a poem, as you said, about 38 Dakota men who were hanged. And it to read the full poem takes about 14 minutes, so which is much too long. So I'm going to read the last few pages. I'm going to start at a point in the poem where I address the Minnesota treaties, which is, Minnesota region is the homeland for traditionally Dakota, Ho-Chunk, and Anishinaabeg people. So I'll start there. These amended and broken treaties are often referred to as the Minnesota Treaties. The word Minnesota comes from Mini, which means water, and Sota, which means turbid. Synonyms for turbid include muddy, unclear, cloudy, confused, and smoky. Everything is in the language we use. For example, a treaty is essentially a contract between two sovereign nations. The U.S. treaties with the Dakota Nation were legal contracts that promised money. It could be said this money was payment for the land the Dakota ceded, for living within assigned boundaries, a reservation, and for relinquishing rights to their vast hunting territory, which in turn made Dakota people dependent on other means to survive, money. The previous sentence is circular, akin to so many aspects of history. As you may have guessed now, the money promised in the turbid treaties did not make it into the hands of Dakota people. In addition, local government traders would not offer credit to, quote, Indians to purchase food or goods. Without money, store credit, or rights to hunt beyond their 10-mile tract of land, Dakota people began to starve. The Dakota people were starving. The Dakota people starved. In the preceding sentence, the word starved does not need italics for emphasis. One should read the Dakota people starved as a straightforward and plainly stated fact. As a result, and without other options but to continue to starve, Dakota people retaliated. Dakota warriors organized, struck out, and killed settlers and traders. This revolt is called the Sioux Uprising. Eventually, the U.S. cavalry came to Minnesota to confront the uprising. More than 1,000 Dakota people were sent to prison. As already mentioned, 38 Dakota men were subsequently hanged. After the hanging, those 1,000 Dakota prisoners were released. However, as further consequence, what remained of Dakota territory in Minnesota was dissolved or stolen. The Dakota people had no land to return to. This means they were exiled. Homeless, the Dakota people of Minnesota were relocated or forced onto reservations in South Dakota and Nebraska. Now, every year, a group called the Dakota 38 plus two riders conduct a memorial horse ride from Lower Brule, South Dakota, to Mankato, Minnesota. The memorial riders travel 325 miles on horseback for 18 days, sometimes through sub-zero blizzards. By the way, if you ever Google the 38 plus two riders, you will really love it, I think. The most beautiful photographs, and there's a beautiful documentary about it. I think you would really enjoy it. They conclude their journey on December 26th, the day of the hanging. Memorials help focus our memory on particular people or events. Often memorials come in the form of plaques, statues, or gravestones. The memorial for the Dakota 38 is not an object inscribed with words, but an act. Yet I started this piece because I was interested in writing about grasses. So there is one other event to include, although it's not in chronological order, and we must backtrack a little. When the Dakota people were starving, as you may remember, government traders would not extend store credit to Indians. One trader named Andrew Myrick is famous for his refusal to provide credit to Dakota people by saying, "If they are hungry, let them eat grass." There are variations of Myrick's words, but they are all something to that effect. When settlers and traders were killed during the Sioux Uprising, one of the first to be executed by the Dakota was Andrew Myrick. When Myrick's body was found, his mouth was stuffed with grass. I am inclined to call this act by the Dakota warriors a poem. There is irony in their poem. There was no text. real poems do not really require words. I have italicized the previous sentence to indicate inner dialogue, a revealing moment. But on second thought, the words, "let them eat grass," click the gears of the poem into place. So we could also say language and word choice are crucial to the poem's work. Things are circling back again. Sometimes, when in a circle, if I wish to exit, I must leap. And let the body swing from the platform out to the grasses. Pilamea, thank you.
Thank you, Leili. One of the questions I had, and you read this, is how might the acts of resistance today, and I'm thinking of Standing Rock, be seen as poems? Seems so many of us resisting are writing poems, Leili. Do you have any thoughts?
I really thought about that question a lot, and I'm going to be honest, I could not come up with a complete answer for you. The reason is, I think sometimes we need time to be able, we need a little distance, a little time to think about it, and at least for me, an event, a moment, it has to sit. And what remains, what resonates in that is where I will find the poem. It's very hard for me to, like, for example, to distill or find that tincture quite yet in, for example, Standing Rock. But I can think of several moments that were very meaningful to me in that, in everything that happened up north. But I'm still working on it. So I need a little time.
Well, thank you. And maybe we could just start with the other writers, Leili and everyone, because brings us to Standing Rock. It seemed to me, Leili and all of our panelists, that in some ways, all of the histories that you touched upon in your work repeats the history of, or Standing Rock, in a way, now is repeating the histories of so much of what you've written about. And it's interesting, if not discouraging, to think that in 2017, the battle has cycled back around again. Any thoughts, any of you, on that?
I'm going to say something on that, and something I was thinking about earlier in relation to the ghost dance. One thing I wanted to mention is I really feel like, and this is my understanding of the ghost dance, it was not a desire to return to the past so much as to call our ancestors forward to help us in the present and to return a sense of power and sovereignty, a sense of self to us, right? And so that is not really wanting to go back. And I think there's always that sensibility among Native people to honor who we are right now, but also that we come from many, many, many before us, right? And so you also see that. You can see how that played out in the present, like with Standing Rock. And one of the things that I have noticed and I've talked about before is how central anyone who is watching or reading any news, how central the idea of prayer was at Standing Rock and how the community itself considered it a ceremony, this act of protecting the water. And everything was done with an attitude, not just an attitude, but an act of prayer. So, and in fact, that was in their, code of conduct or that they had come up with. And the very last line was to acknowledge that this is a ceremony. So your behavior should reflect that if you're coming to the community. So did I answer your question? I don't know.
You may have even answered the one about a poem. All right. Anybody else want to touch on that? I want to say something quickly, too. You know, again, California Indians, not much is said, but, you know, we had the very strong version of the ghost dance. We call it the Bole Maru or the dream dance here. And it was somewhat different from the way you characterized it there, because ours, while we did go to the white churches and work for the white people and stuff, in the roundhouses, we preached through the visions of these our leaders a fierce nationalism, where in fact the white man was the devil. And we called back the ancestors to dance with us, and that was the thing, because the ancestors would come and guide and protect us in these hard times. And it was to be kept very secret. Of course, we would get shot down because they always suspected we were uprising or going to kill the people that had us in pens. But anyway, yeah, so want to continue on with that question. The repeat, any of you want to, you've all touched on it in your work.
on the question of Standing Rock or the question?
Standing Rock and the history there. Yeah. I mean, because your book, a lot happened in yeah. that same reservation, as did yours.
Right. The Standing Rock is where, during the government's induced ghost dance crisis, the government killed Sitting Bull, arresting him on December 15th. And if you read the documents for that event, there was no reason to arrest him at all. None. The agent who was in charge of the reservation just didn't like him. And there was no reason for that either. If you read the relations between the two men, you can see that Sitting Bull actually has tried extremely hard with this very difficult man. But he orders him arrested, and Sitting Bull ends up being killed. And it's very hard to conclude it was anything but an assassination. As I watched the events unfurl at Standing Rock, and like I think most of you, I learned about it from TV and from the internet and from newspapers. So piecing it together as much as I could, what struck me was this occupation was so remarkably, I'm trying to find the language, and Layli Long Soldier's poetry merely makes me think really hard about language, right? I'm now obviously. This occupation was so innovative. When you watched these people, there was always something new and different happening. There were all of these sort of artistic installations. So the rules that the community established for living, the arrival and gathering of just native people, not only from all over the United States, from all over the world, right? Sami show up from Northern Europe, right? This sort of indigenous gathering. And there's something really powerful and profound going on here about our future. Not just the future, as they would say this, it's not just about the future of Native people. This is about the future of humanity. Where are we going? Right? It was profound. And I found that very forward-looking. And then the official response was hundreds, thousands of county sheriff's deputies, North Dakota state troopers, National Guardsmen, and I don't even know what other agencies of law enforcement. The people I know who went told me stories about snipers on the hilltops. There were armored personnel carriers, heavily armed troops. One of my favorite moments was an artist shows up. I don't remember the name of the artist. I'm sorry, I don't. I should. But made shields that were reflective, right, for the demonstrators to hold against the rubber bullets and the tear gas, right, and just to defend themselves. And the reflective shield was so that the troops who were doing this to them must confront what they are doing. We must show them what they are doing to us. I don't know if it changed their behavior, but I thought it was brilliant, right? It's just beautiful. But the law enforcement response was very old-fashioned. It was very much like the response to the ghost dance, right? And about the time the governor of North Dakota, right, started saying, no, I will end this. I'm going to end this very soon. If you read the Ghost Dance documents, there comes a moment in December when the officials start saying, you know, we just have to end this to save the Indians because it's getting cold and they're going to freeze to death dancing out there. So we're going to stop them from dancing and save them. And the governor of North Dakota said, these demonstrators are going to freeze to death. We're going to clear that encampment. Now, fortunately, he didn't do it. Right, but the way that we in this country, that officialdom and so much of white America, I think, is still caught in that cycle that puts us right back as if it were 1890. Very backward-looking official response, as opposed to this innovative, forward-looking, indigenous moment.
Well, yeah, it reminds me very much, even before 1890, of 1873, which is when Custer first encountered the Lakota people. He was transferred to the Dakota Territory, and he played a role in escorting the survey party for the Northern Pacific Railroad, which was running along the Yellowstone River, at one of the second wave of transcontinental railroads. And as Richard White put it in the book Railroaded, the U.S. government transferred to railroad corporations land very cheaply because it didn't belong to them. It belonged to Native people. And you know, the whole idea of running it through this area, this piece of fixed economic infrastructure to serve this economy and to serve a sense of the landscape. There are these boundaries that the U.S. and other states drew in North America that had nothing to do with the people who had lived there before, you know, settlers arrived from Europe. And that idea of who actually owns and has sovereignty over the landscape drives this process and this partnership between the corporation and the state, which carries straight through into Standing Rock. And, you know, there are the various Native ways of seeing a spiritual way of seeing the landscape. And the same is true in U.S. history, because we have this whole invisible world filled with invisible beings, with invisible property, and they're called corporations, and they're called shares. And we've built this economy that, you know, it works, but it's all based on stuff that we've just invented. It's not there in nature. It's not objective. It's subjective. It's something we came up with. And so we're imposing one invisible universe on the physical world, on people whose sort of trans, their own sense of that world is different. And the idea is that, well, this one really makes sense. You know, this is the way to really see it. And it's also in partnership with this corporate infrastructure and these corporate entities. You know, they originally were created by the state to carry out public goals. The transcontinental railroads and earlier corporations were created to serve these public goals. We're going to create first canals and banks, and then we're going to create railroads, and it's going to serve the state national interest. And that's very much the way in which these pipeline debates are, that this is a national interest, and that, yes, they're private corporations, but it also serves this national interest. And the debate is actually very much the same as it was in the 19th century. And again, the idea of that there's a non sort of European world system, if I can call it that, view of the landscape and that it has any legitimacy and of natural resources. You know, that is in, those are in conflict. And as was just said, you know, this is not forward versus backwards looking. If anything, the, you know, the kind of carbon-based national interest way of looking at that world and of driving forward these pipeline construction is actually, if anything, destructive and backward looking.
Thank you, everybody. We read history, as I often tell my students and others, so that we might learn something as we go forward. And I think more than anything today, we need to go forward. The old people, my older people, always used to say, at the end of the world or when the times were going to change, the white people will be coming back and looking at us for answers. We also called the Europeans palacha, or miracles, and I used to ask the old people, why do you call them miracles? And they said, well, when they, we always thought, it, you know, they, here they come and they chop down trees and they kill people and kill animals, and if we did that, you know, we always believed things would come back on us. And you know, they said they just, they kept doing that and more of them kept coming, so we thought they were miraculous. But you know, all we had to do is wait until 2017 and see that it is all coming back on us. So now we all must go forward. I think we have a time for one or two questions in the audience, and then we'll have the book signing in out in the lobby. So if anybody has a burning question or two, I think we have about 5 minutes. I was supposed to give you 10 minutes, but I thought the discussion was good. Anybody? I can't see too well, so maybe our...
This one over there.
Okay. Yes, you can speak. Would you hand the person the mic? Thank you so much.
Just quickly, one question, but first, a thank you for a brilliant discussion this morning. The question was, I had heard, and I haven't read much about this in general media, that there is now a generation of Native American trained in legal issues involving all the past contracts and treaties that the U.S. government has not honored, and that these lawsuits and legal issues are moving forward in a way that will require the U.S. government to honor past treaties. And I wondered if any of you had any insight into whether that, in other words, playing the game of this national corporate structure that you've been talking about, finding a way to use the legal system that currently operates in this country as a way of restoring some measure of at least the contracts, the treaty rights that have been denied for so long. It would, I'm told, empower many Native American communities because land was promised that was never given.
Would any of the panelists like to respond?
Don't look at me. I don't want to. No. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about, you know, kind of digging in into and thinking about the history of kind of indigenous peoples in the hemisphere actually is how effective Native peoples have been at using the so-called courts of the conquerors. You know, so for instance, even in 17th century Spanish colonies, Native peoples had access to court systems and were able to kind of sue Spanish colonial officials for aggrievements. Native peoples have been involved in court cases and throughout the 20th century trying to reclaim land. Sometimes they win, sometimes they lose, but what I think has been pretty, this even kind of goes back to the Cherokee cases in the 1830s is, you know, one of the things that I always joke with my class is if you're ever aggrieved in the United States, what do? You sue, right? You go to court, and Cherokee people kind of pick this up pretty quickly. So I think that Native people have been pretty pretty wise and intelligent about kind of being able to kind of take advantage of the of those courts and those court systems. And so even going forward, hopefully courts can recognize kind of the inherent sovereignty of Native peoples. Whether or not they will going forward remains to be seen.
That's a really good question, and I want to just touch on sort of underline some of the things Willie said. If you look at the history of the land issues at Standing Rock, for example, I mean, the whole place was, I mean, it was stolen. There were treaties that were signed that are not, that by the terms of the prior treaties could not have been valid. They were forced on these people. In order to overturn those treaties, it would mean returning a large chunk of Western South Dakota. And when the Supreme Court has looked at this before, as they have in the 1970s, early 80s, they ordered a cash restoration to the Lakota people, which came out to, I don't remember if anybody remembers, it was like 300, it worked out to some hundreds of dollars per person. It was millions of dollars, but there are lots of Lakotas, and it was hundreds of dollars per person. They refused to pick it up. They refused to accept that check, right? So that I think there's law. Law can be a really important tool, but it has so much of what happened under the cover of law. And to turn that back over sometimes will only get you as far as that 1970s or 80s judgment from the Supreme Court, which is clearly not far enough.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Again, I want to thank Steve Silberstein for sponsoring this panel. And I want to remind you that the authors will be signing their books out here in the lobby. And I want to thank you for taking the time, coming this morning, and for caring. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.